This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents What Went Wrong? Western Impact and Middle Eastern Response by Bernard Lewis. Read by John Lee. Preface. This book was already in page proof when the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington took place on September the 11th, 2001. It does not, therefore, deal with them, nor with their immediate causes and after-effects. It is, however, related to these attacks, examining not what happened and what followed, but what went before, the larger sequence and larger pattern of events, ideas, and attitudes that preceded and in some measure produced them. B.L., Princeton, New Jersey, October 15, 2001. Introduction. What went wrong? For a long time, people in the Islamic world, especially but not exclusively in the Middle East, have been asking this question. The content and formulation of the question, provoked primarily by their encounter with the West, vary greatly according to the circumstances, extent, and duration of that encounter, and the events that first made them conscious, by comparison, that all was not well in their own society. But whatever the form and manner of the question and of the answers that it evokes, there is no mistaking the growing anguish, the mounting urgency, and of late, the seething anger with which both question and answers are expressed. There is indeed good reason for questioning and concern, even for anger. For many centuries, the world of Islam was in the forefront of human civilization and achievement. In the Muslim's own perception, Islam itself was indeed coterminous with civilization, and beyond its borders there were only barbarians and infidels. This perception of self and other was enjoyed by most, if not all, other civilization: Greece, Rome, India, China, and one could add more recent examples. In the era between the decline of antiquity and the dawn of modernity, that is, in the centuries designated in European history as medieval, the Islamic claim was not without justification. Muslims were, of course, aware that there were other, more or less civilized societies on earth, in China, in India, in Christendom. But China was remote and little known. India was in process of subjugation and Islamization. Christendom had a certain special importance in that it constituted the only serious rival to Islam as a world faith and a world power. But in the Muslim view, the faith was superseded by the final Islamic revelation, and the power was being steadily overcome by the greater divinely guided power of Islam. For most medieval Muslims, Christendom meant primarily the Byzantine Empire, which gradually became smaller and weaker, until its final disappearance with the Turkish conquest of Constantinople in 1453. The remoter lands of Europe were seen in much the same light as the remoter lands of Africa, as an outer darkness of barbarism and unbelief, from which there was nothing to learn, and little even to be imported, except slaves and raw materials. For both the northern and southern barbarians, their best hope was to be incorporated in the empire of the caliphs, and thus attain the benefits of religion and civilization. For the first 1,000 years or so after the advent of Islam, this seemed not unlikely, and Muslims made repeated attempts to accomplish it. In the course of the 7th century, Muslim armies advancing from Arabia conquered Syria, Palestine, Egypt, and North Africa, all until then part of Christendom, and most of the new recruits to Islam, west of Iran and Arabia, were indeed converts from Christianity. In the 8th century, from their bases in North Africa, Arab Muslim forces, now joined by Berber converts, conquered Spain and Portugal and invaded France. In the 9th century, they conquered Sicily and invaded the Italian mainland. In 846 of the Common Era, a naval expedition from Sicily even entered the River Tiber, and Arab forces sacked Ostia and Rome. This provoked the first attempts to organize an effective Christian counterattack. A subsequent series of campaigns to recover the Holy Land, known as the Crusades, ended in failure and expulsion. In Europe, Christian arms were more successful. By the end of the 11th century, the Muslims had been expelled from Sicily, and in 1492, almost 8 centuries after the first Muslim landing in Spain, the long struggle for the reconquest ended in victory, opening the way to a Christian invasion of Africa and Asia. But meanwhile, there were other Muslim threats to European Christendom. In the east, between 1237 and 1240 of the Common Era, the Tatars of the Golden Horde conquered Russia. In 1252, the Khan of the Golden Horde and his people were converted to Islam. Russia, with much of Eastern Europe, was subject to Muslim rule. And it was not until the late 15th century that the Russians finally freed their country from what they called the Tatar yoke. In the meantime, a third wave of Muslim attack had begun, that of the Ottoman Turks, who conquered Anatolia, captured the ancient Christian city of Constantinople, invaded and colonized the Balkan Peninsula, and threatened the very heart of Europe, twice reaching as far as Vienna. At the peak of Islamic power, there was only one civilization that was comparable in the level, quality, and variety of achievement. That was, of course, China. But Chinese civilization remained essentially local, limited to one region, East Asia, and to one racial group. It was exported to some degree, but only to neighboring and kindred peoples. Islam, in contrast, created a world civilization, polyethnic, multiracial, international, one might even say intercontinental. For centuries, the worldview and self-view of Muslims seemed well-grounded. Islam represented the greatest military power on earth. Its armies, at the very same time, were invading Europe and Africa, India and China. It was the foremost economic power in the world, trading in a wide range of commodities through a far-flung network of commerce and communications in Asia, Europe and Africa, importing slaves and gold from Africa, slaves and wool from Europe, and exchanging a variety of foodstuffs, materials and manufactures with the civilized countries of Asia. It had achieved the highest level so far in human history in the arts and sciences of civilization. Inheriting the knowledge and skills of the ancient Middle East, of Greece and of Persia, it added to them new and important innovations from outside, such as the use and manufacture of paper from China and decimal positional numbering from India. It is difficult to imagine modern literature or science without the one or the other. It was in the Islamic Middle East that Indian numbers were for the first time incorporated in the inherited body of mathematical learning. From the Middle East, they were transmitted to the West, where they are still known as Arabic numerals, honoring not those who invented them, but those who first brought them to Europe. To this rich inheritance, scholars and scientists in the Islamic world added an immensely important contribution through their own observations, experiments, and ideas. In most of the arts and sciences of civilization, medieval Europe was a pupil, and in a sense a dependent of the Islamic world, relying on Arabic versions even for many otherwise unknown Greek works. And then, suddenly, the relationship changed. Even before the Renaissance, Europeans were beginning to make significant progress in the civilized arts. With the advent of the new learning, they advanced by leaps and bounds, leaving the scientific and technological and eventually the cultural heritage of the Islamic world far behind them. The Muslims, for a long time, remained unaware of this. The great translation movement that centuries earlier had brought many Greek, Persian, and Syriac works within the purview of Muslim and other Arabic readers had come to an end, and the new scientific literature of Europe was almost totally unknown to them. Until the late 18th century, only one medical book was translated into a Middle Eastern language, a 16th century treatise on syphilis, presented to Sultan Mehmed IV in Turkish, 1655. Both the choice and the date are significant. This disease, reputedly of American origin, had come to the Islamic world from Europe, and indeed is still known in Arabic, Persian, Turkish, and other languages as the Frankish disease. Obviously, it seemed both appropriate and legitimate to adopt a Frankish remedy for a Frankish disease. Apart from that, the Renaissance, the Reformation, The technological revolution passed virtually unnoticed in the lands of Islam, where they were still inclined to dismiss the denizens of the lands beyond the western frontier as benighted barbarians, much inferior even to the more sophisticated Asian infidels to the east. These had useful skills and devices to impart. The Europeans had neither. It was a judgment that had for long been reasonably accurate. It was becoming dangerously out of date. Usually, the lessons of history are most perspicuously and unequivocally taught on the battlefield, but there may be some delay before the lesson is understood and applied. In Christendom, the final defeat of the Moors in Spain in 1492 and the liberation of Russia from the rule of Islamized Tatars were understandably seen as decisive victories. Like the Spaniards and Portuguese, the Russians too pursued their former masters into their homelands, but with far greater and more enduring success. With the conquest of Astrakhan in 1554, the Russians reached the shores of the Caspian Sea. In the following century, they reached the northern shore of the Black Sea, thus beginning the long process of conquest and colonization that incorporated vast Muslim lands in the Russian Empire. But in the heartlands of Islam, these happenings on the remote frontiers of civilization seemed less important and were, in any case, overshadowed in Muslim eyes by such central and vastly more important victories as the ignominious eviction of the Crusaders from the Levant in the 13th century, the capture of Constantinople in 1453, and the triumphant march of the Turkish forces through the Balkans toward the surviving Christian imperial city of Vienna in what seemed to be an irresistible advance of Islam and defeat of Christendom. The Ottoman Sultan, like his peer and rival the Holy Roman Emperor, was not without political rivals and sectarian challengers within his own religious world. Of the two, the Sultan was the more successful in dealing with these challenges. At the turn of the 15th to 16th centuries, the Ottomans had two Muslim neighbors. The older of the two was the Mamluk Sultanate of Egypt, with its capital in Cairo, ruling over all Syria and Palestine and, more important, over the holy places of Islam in Western Arabia. The other was Persia, newly united by a new dynasty, with a new religious militancy. The founder of the dynasty, Shah Ismail Safavi, reigned 1501 to 1524, a Turkish-speaking Shiite from Azerbaijan, brought all the lands of Iran under a single ruler for the first time since the Arab conquest in the 7th century. A religious leader as well as, perhaps more than, a political and military ruler, he made Shiism the official religion of the state, and thus differentiated the Muslim realm of Iran sharply from its Sunni neighbors on both sides, to the east in Central Asia and India, and to the west in the Ottoman Empire. For a while, he and his successors, the Shahs of the Safavid line, challenged the claim of the Ottoman sultans to both political supremacy and religious leadership. The Ottoman sultan, Selim I, known as the Grim, who reigned from 1512 to 1520, launched military campaigns against both neighbors. He achieved a substantial but incomplete success against the Shah, a total and final victory over the Mamluk Sultan of Egypt. Egypt and its dependencies were incorporated in the Ottoman realms. Persia remained a separate, rival, and, for the most part, hostile state. Buzbek, the imperial ambassador in Istanbul, went so far as to say that it was only the threat from Persia that saved Europe from imminent conquest by the Turks. On the Turks' side are the resources of a mighty empire, strength unimpaired, habituation to victory, endurance of toil, unity, discipline, frugality, and watchfulness. On our side is public poverty, private luxury, impaired strength, broken spirit, lack of endurance and training. The soldiers are insubordinate, the officers avaricious, there is contempt for discipline, license, recklessness, drunkenness, and debauchery are rife. And worst of all, the enemy is accustomed to victory, and we to defeat. Can we doubt what the result will be? Persia alone interposes in our favor. For the enemy, as he hastens to attack, must keep an eye on this menace in his rear. But Persia is only delaying our fate. It cannot save us. When the Turks have settled with Persia, they will fly at our throats, supported by the might of the whole East. How unprepared we are, I dare not say. There have been more recent Western observers who spoke of the Soviet Union and China in similar terms, and proved equally mistaken. Buzbek's fears, as it turned out, were unjustified. The Ottomans and the Persians continued to fight each other until the 19th century, by which time they no longer constituted a threat to anyone but their own subjects. At the time, the idea of a possible anti-Ottoman alliance between Christendom and Persia was occasionally mooted, but to little effect. In 1523, Shah Ismail, still smarting after his defeat, sent a letter to the Emperor Charles V, expressing surprise that the European powers were fighting each other instead of joining forces against the Ottomans. The appeal fell on deaf ears, and the Emperor did not send a reply to Shah Ismail until 1529, by which time the Shah had been dead for 5 years. For the time being, Persia was immobilized, and under Selim's successor, Suleiman the Magnificent, reigned 1520 to 1566, the Ottomans were able to embark on a new phase of expansion in Europe. The Great Battle of Mohács in Hungary in August 1526 gave the Turks a decisive victory and opened the way to the first siege of Vienna in 1529. The failure to capture Vienna on that occasion was seen on both sides as a delay, not a defeat, and opened a long struggle for mastery in the heart of Europe. Here and there, the Christian powers managed to achieve some successes, and one notable victory, the great naval battle of Lepanto in the Gulf of Patras in Greece in 1571. In Europe, indeed, this was acclaimed as a major triumph. All Christendom exulted in this victory, and King James VI of Scotland, later James I of England, was even moved to compose a long and ecstatic poem in celebration. The Turkish archives preserve the report of the Kapudan Pasha, the senior officer commanding the fleet, whose account of the Battle of Lepanto is just two lines. The fleet of the divinely guided empire encountered the fleet of the wretched infidels, and the will of Allah turned the other way. As a military report, this may be somewhat lacking in detail, but not in frankness. In Ottoman histories, the battle is known simply as Sımgam, a Turkish word meaning a rout or crushing defeat. But how much difference did Lepanto make? The answer must be very little. If we look at the larger question of naval power, let alone the far more important question of military power in the region, Lepanto was no more than a minor setback for the Ottomans, quickly made good. The situation is well reflected in a conversation reported by an Ottoman chronicler, who tells us that when Sultan Selim II asked the Grand Vizier Sokolu Mehmed Pasha about the cost of rebuilding the fleet after its destruction at Lepanto, the vizier replied, "The might and wealth of our empire are such that if we desired to equip the entire fleet with silver anchors, silken rigging, and satin sails, we could do it." This is obviously a poetic exaggeration, but a fairly accurate reflection of the real significance of Lepanto, a great shot in the arm in the west, a minor ripple in the east. The major threat remained. In the 17th century, there were still Turkish pashas ruling in Budapest and Belgrade, and Barbary corsairs from North Africa were raiding the coasts of England and Ireland, and even, in 1627, Iceland, bringing back human booty for sale in the slave markets of Algiers. In the late 16th and early 17th centuries, Persia once again became a factor of importance in the struggle. Shah Abbas I, known as the Great, was in many ways the most successful ruler of his line. In 1598, returning to his capital after a victory against the Uzbeks of Central Asia, he was approached by a group of Europeans, led by two English brothers, Sir Anthony and Sir Robert Shirley. Probably at their suggestion, he sent letters of friendship to the Pope, the Holy Roman Emperor, and various European monarchs and rulers, including the Queen of England and the Doge of Venice. These missives produced little result. Of greater importance was a reorganization and re-equipment of his armed forces, undertaken with the Shirleys and other Europeans' help. Between 1602 and 1612, and again between 1616 and 1627, Persia and Turkey were at war, and the Persians won a number of successes. Distracted by this struggle in the east, the Turks were obliged, in 1606, to make peace with the Austrians. The Treaty of Sitvatorok, signed in that year, is notable for a number of reasons. All previous treaties had been dictated by the Turks in their capital, Istanbul. This one was negotiated on neutral ground, on an island in the Danube, between the two sides. Perhaps even more significant was the recognition of the emperor as Padishah. Until then, it had been the normal practice of the Ottomans to designate European rulers either by subordinate Ottoman titles, such as Bey, or more commonly, by what they thought to be European titles. Thus, for example, Ottoman letters to Queen Elizabeth addressed her as Queen Kiralise of the Vilayet of England, while the emperor was addressed as King Kural of Vienna. Kural and Kuralise are, of course, terms of European, not Turkish, origin, and were used by Ottomans in much the same way as Imperial Britain used native titles for native princes in India. Addressing the emperor as Padishah, the title that the Ottoman sultans themselves used, was a formal recognition of equality. While generally contemptuous of the infidel West, Muslims were not unaware of Western skills in weaponry and warfare. The initial successes of the Crusaders in the Levant impressed upon Muslim war departments that, in some areas at least, Western arms were superior, and the inference was quickly drawn and applied. Western prisoners of war were set to work building fortifications. Western mercenaries and adventurers were employed, and a traffic in arms and other war materials began that grew steadily in the course of the centuries. Even when the Ottoman Turks were advancing into southeastern Europe, they were always able to buy much-needed equipment for their fleets and armies from Christian European suppliers, to recruit European experts, and even to obtain financial cover from Christian European banks. What is nowadays known as constructive engagement has a long history. All this, however, had little or no influence on Muslim perceptions and attitudes, as long as Muslim armies continued to be victorious in the heartlands. The sultans bought war materials and military expertise for cash, and saw in this no more than a business transaction. The Turks, in particular, adopted such European inventions as handguns and artillery, and used them to great effect, without thereby modifying their view of the barbarian infidels from whom they acquired these weapons. There were some dissenting voices. As early as the 16th century, an Ottoman grand vizier in his retirement observed that while the Muslim forces were supreme on the land, the infidels were getting stronger on the sea. We must overcome them. His message received little attention. In the early 17th century, another Ottoman official noted an alarming presence of Portuguese, Dutch, and English merchant shipping in Asian waters, and warned of a possible danger from that source. The danger was real and growing. When the Portuguese navigator Vasco da Gama sailed around Africa into the Indian Ocean at the end of the 15th century, he opened a new sea route between Europe and Asia, with far-reaching consequences for the Middle East, first commercial, later also strategic. As early as 1502, the Republic of Venice, the prime European beneficiary of the Eastern spice trade, sent an emissary to Cairo to warn the Sultan of Egypt of the danger that this new sea route presented to their commerce. At first, the Sultan paid little attention, but a sharp decline in his customs revenues focused his attention more sharply on this new problem. Egyptian naval expeditions against the Portuguese in eastern waters were, however, unsuccessful, and no doubt contributed to the defeat of the Egyptian Sultanate in 1516 to 1517, and the incorporation of all its dominions in the Ottoman realm. The Ottomans now took over this task, but fared little better. Their efforts to counter the Portuguese in the Horn of Africa and the Red Sea were at best inconclusive. The lack of Ottoman interest in these developments is best illustrated by the response to an appeal for help from Aceh in Sumatra. In 1563, the Muslim ruler of Aceh sent an embassy to Istanbul asking for help against the Portuguese and adding, as an inducement, that several of the non-Muslim rulers of the region had agreed to turn Muslim if the Ottomans would come to their aid. But the Ottomans were busy with more urgent matters. The sieges of Malta and of Sigetvar in Hungary, the death of Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. After 2 years' delay, they finally assembled a fleet of 19 galleys and some other ships carrying weapons and supplies to help the beleaguered Atjenese. Most of the ships, however, never got there. The greater part of the expedition was diverted to the more urgent task of restoring and extending Ottoman authority in the Yemen, and in fact, only two ships carrying gunfounders, gunners, and engineers, as well as some guns and other war material, actually reached Aceh, where they were taken into the service of the local ruler and used in his unsuccessful attempts to expel the Portuguese. The incident seems to have passed unnoticed at the time and is known only from documents in the Turkish archives. Whether through negligence or design, the Ottomans were probably fortunate in not challenging the Portuguese naval power in the eastern seas. Their fleet of Mediterranean-style galleys would have fared badly against the Portuguese carracks and galleons, built for the Atlantic, and therefore bigger, heavier, better armed, and more maneuverable. The impact of the new open ocean route between Europe and Asia on the transit commerce of the Middle East was less than was at one time thought. Throughout the 16th century, the Middle Eastern transit trade in spices and other commodities between South and Southeast Asia on the one hand and Mediterranean Europe on the other continued to flourish. But in the 17th century, a new and, for the Middle East, far more dangerous situation arose. By that time, Portuguese, Dutch, and other Europeans in Asia were no longer there simply as merchants. They were establishing bases that in time became colonial dependencies. As their power was extended from the sea to the seaports and even to the interior, the new European empires in Asia, controlling the points both of arrival and of departure in East-West commerce, effectively outflanked the Middle East. The danger was not confined to West European expansion into South Asia. There was also the Russian expansion into North Asia, where, again, Muslim rulers turned to the greatest Muslim power of the time, the Ottoman Empire, for help. There was some response. In 1568, the Ottomans drew up a plan to dig a canal through the Isthmus of Suez from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. The following year, they actually began to dig a canal between the Don and the Volga rivers. Their purpose, clearly, was to extend their naval power beyond the Mediterranean, on the one hand to the Red Sea and Indian Ocean, and on the other to the Black Sea and the Caspian. But both operations, so it seems, were seen by the Ottomans as sideshows and abandoned when they proved troublesome. By the end of the 16th century, the Ottomans withdrew from active participation on both fronts, against the Russians in North and Central Asia, against the West Europeans in South and Southeast Asia. Instead, they concentrated their main effort on the struggle in Europe that they saw, not without reason, as the principal battleground between Islam and Christendom, the rival faiths competing for the enlightenment and mastery of the world. Western successes on the battlefield and on the high seas were accompanied by less resounding but more pervasive and ultimately more dangerous victories in the marketplace. The discovery and exploitation of the New World for the first time provided Christian Europe with ample supplies of gold and silver. The fertile lands of their new colonial possessions enabled them to grow new crops, including even such previous imports from the Middle East as coffee and sugar, and to export them to their former suppliers. The growing European presence in South and Southeast Asia accelerated and expanded this process, and old established handicrafts faced the double challenge of Asian cheap labor and European commercial skills. The Western Trading Company, helped by its business-minded government, represented a new force in the Middle East. Here again, an occasional voice expressed some concern, but was little heeded. Yet these developments and the accompanying changes in both internal and external affairs aggravated old problems and created new ones of increasing range and complexity, monetary, fiscal, financial, and eventually economic, social, and cultural. For most of the 17th century, there were no major changes in the balance of military forces. Until almost the mid-century, Europe was absorbed in the Thirty Years' War and its aftermath, while the Ottomans were preoccupied with problems at home and on their eastern frontier. A war with the Republic of Venice began in 1645, and at first went rather badly for the Turks. In 1656, the Venetians, who for some years had blockaded the straits, were even able to send their fleet into the Dardanelles and win a naval victory. In that same year, Mehmed Korpulu, an Albanian pasha, was appointed Grand Vizier. During his term of office, 1656 to 1661, and that of his son and successor, Ahmed Korpulu, 1661 to 1678, the Ottoman state underwent a remarkable transformation. These skilled, energetic, and ruthless rulers were able to reorganize the armed forces of the empire, stabilize its finances, and resume the struggle in Christian Europe. An area of intensive activity was Poland and the Ukraine, and it was here that, for the first time, the Ottomans came into conflict with Russia. By the Treaty of Radzin of 1681, the Turks gave up their claims on the Ukraine and agreed to give the Cossacks trading rights in the Black Sea. It was a portentous change, marking the emergence of a new and more dangerous enemy, and the beginning of a long, hard, and bitter struggle. Meanwhile, a new Grand Vizier had been appointed. Kara Mustafa Pasha was a brother-in-law of Mehmed Korpulu, and felt it his duty to restore the glory of the Korpulu Vizierial dynasty. In 1682, he launched a new war against Austria, culminating in a second siege of Vienna between July 17th and September 12th, 1683. This second unsuccessful attempt to capture the city is best described in the words of the contemporary Ottoman chronicler, Silidar. "This was a calamitous defeat, so great that there has never been its like since the first appearance of the Ottoman state." One must admire the frankness with which the Ottomans faced unpleasant realities. The failure before Vienna was followed by a series of further defeats. In 1686, with the loss of Buda, a century and a half of Ottoman rule in Hungary came to an end. The event is commemorated in a Turkish lament of the time. "In the fountains they no longer wash, in the mosques they no longer pray. The places that prospered are now desolate. The Austrian has taken our beautiful Buddha." The retreat from Vienna opened new opportunities. In March 1684, Austria, Venice, Poland, Tuscany, and Malta, with the blessing of the Pope, formed a Holy League to fight the Ottoman Empire. Russia joined the Catholic powers in this enterprise. Under Tsar Peter, known as the Great, they went to war against the Ottomans and achieved signal successes. On August 6, 1696, Peter the Great captured Azov, the first Russian stronghold on the shore of the Black Sea. By now the Turks were ready to discuss peace. The peace process began with secret negotiations between the Austrian Chancellor and a newly appointed Ottoman Grand Vizier, who, significantly, was accompanied by his Grand Dragoman, the Istanbul Greek Alexander Mavrokordato. In October 1698, the diplomats met at Karlovitz in the Vojvodina, newly conquered by the Austrians from the Turks. Finally, on January the 26th, 1699, with the help of British and Dutch mediation, a peace treaty between the Ottoman Empire and the Holy League was signed at Karlowitz. A little later, a separate agreement with the Russians confirmed the cession to them of Azov. The Ottomans had suffered serious territorial losses. They had also been obliged to abandon old concepts and old ways of dealing with the outside world, and to learn a new science of diplomacy, negotiation, and mediation. The war was not a total defeat, and the treaty was not a total surrender. In the early 18th century, they were even able to make some recovery. But even so, the military result was unequivocal. The shattering defeat outside Vienna, the devastating loss of lives, stores, and equipment, and of course, the cession of territory. The lesson was clear, and the Turks set to work to learn and apply it. Chapter 1. The Lessons of the Battlefield. The Treaty of Karlowitz has a special importance in the history of the Ottoman Empire, and even more broadly, in the history of the Islamic world, as the first peace signed by a defeated Ottoman Empire with victorious Christian adversaries. In a global perspective, this was not entirely new. There had been previous defeats of Islam by Christendom, the loss of Spain and Portugal, the rise of Russia, the growing European presence in South and Southeast Asia. But few observers at that time, Muslim or Western, could command a global perspective. In the perspective of the Muslim heartlands in the Middle East, these events were remote and peripheral, barely affecting the balance of power between the Islamic and Christian worlds in the long struggle that had been going on between them since the advent of Islam in the 7th century and the eruption of the Muslim armies from Arabia into the then Christian lands of Syria, Palestine, Egypt, North Africa, and, for a while, southern Europe. The Crusaders had briefly halted the triumphal march of Islam, but they had been held, defeated, and ejected. The Muslim advance had continued with the extinction of Byzantium and the Ottoman entry into Europe. The Empire of Constantinople had fallen. The Holy Roman Empire was next. Ottoman, and more broadly Muslim, consciousness of the world in which they lived is reflected in the very copious historical literature that they produced and, in greater detail, in the millions of documents preserved in the Ottoman archives, illustrating the functioning of the Ottoman state year by year, almost day by day, in its manifold activities. There are occasional references to the loss of Spain, but it appears as a relatively minor issue, far away, not threatening. There is some mention of the arrival of Muslim refugees and of Jewish refugees who came from Spain to the Ottoman lands, but little more. The peace signed at Karlowitz drove home two lessons. The first was military, defeat by superior force. The second lesson, more complex, was diplomatic, and was learnt in the process of negotiation. In the early centuries of Ottoman experience, a treaty was a simple matter. The Ottoman government dictated its terms, and the defeated enemy accepted them. After the first siege of Vienna, there was, for a while, some sort of negotiation, and even, a startling innovation, a concession to the Kaiser of equal status with the Sultan, but no conclusive result one way or the other. In negotiating the Treaty of Karlowitz, the Ottomans had, for the first time, to resort to that strange art we call diplomacy, by which they tried, through political means, to modify or even to reduce the results of the military outcome. For the Ottoman officials, this was a new task, one in which they had no experience. How to negotiate the best terms they could after a military defeat? In this, they had some assistance, some guidance, from two foreign embassies in Istanbul, those of Britain and of the Netherlands. The Ottomans at first were unwilling to accept what they regarded as Christian interference, but they soon learned to recognize and make use of such help. The Western maritime and commercial states had no interest in the consolidation and extension of Austrian power and influence in Central and Eastern Europe, and thought it would be more to their advantage to have a weakened but surviving Ottoman Empire, in which their merchants could come and go at will. The British and Dutch emissaries managed to provide the Ottomans with some discreet help and advice, and were even able to take part in the negotiation of the peace treaty. Western help was not limited to diplomacy. Military help, the supply of weapons, even the financing of purchases, were old and familiar, going back beyond the beginnings of the Ottoman state to the time of the Crusades. What was new was for the Ottomans to seek European help in training and equipping their forces, and to form alliances with European powers against other European powers. In the first half of the 18th century, the struggle was indecisive, and even brought some gains for the Ottomans. In 1710 and 1711, they won a significant victory over the Russians, who, by the Treaty of the Pruth, 1711, were obliged to return the peninsula of Azov. But another war against Venice, and then against Austria, ended with another defeat and further territorial losses, specified in the Treaty of Passarowitz of 1718. At about that time, we have an Ottoman document recording, or to be more accurate, purporting to record, a conversation between two officers, one a Christian, not more precisely described, the other an Ottoman Muslim. The purpose of the document is obviously propagandistic. It is, to my knowledge, the first Muslim document in which Muslim and Christian methods of warfare are compared, to the advantage of the latter, and the previously unthinkable suggestion is advanced that the true believers should follow the infidels in military organization and the conduct of warfare. The document laid great stress, in particular, on the Christian use of firepower, both cannon and muskets, and on the training and reorganizations of their forces to make the most effective use of both. The superior skill of the Austrian lies only in the use of the musket. They cannot face the sword. The thrust of the argument was that it was no longer sufficient, as in the past, to adopt Western weapons. It was also necessary to adopt Western training, structures, and tactics for their effective use. That was bad enough. Even worse was that this adoption by the Ottomans, and later the Persians and other Muslim armies, did not produce the desired result. The military confrontation revealed in a dramatic form the root cause of the new imbalance. The problem was not, as was once argued, one of decline. The Ottoman state and armed forces were as effective as they had ever been, in traditional terms. In this, as in much else, it was European invention and experiment that changed the balance of power between the two sides. The course of modernization, even in this limited sense, was by no means easy. It was denounced, it was resisted, it was interrupted. The case for modernization was considerably weakened by one of the many wars between Turkey and Iran that ended in 1730, with a victory for the even less modernized Persians. This did not strengthen the case of the modernizers in Turkey. For a while, things went rather better in Europe. The growing rivalry between their two main enemies in the north, Austria and Russia, helped the Ottomans to recover some ground. But then a new disaster struck. Between 1768 and 1774, the Ottomans suffered a series of defeats at the hands of the Russians. The result was registered in the Treaty of Küçük-Kaynarca of 1774, which gave the Russians rights of navigation and indirectly of intervention within the Ottoman Empire. Of more immediate importance was the clause concerning the Crimea, previously an Ottoman dependency, inhabited by Turkish-speaking Muslims. The Sultan was now compelled to recognize the independence of the Khans of the Crimea. As it soon became clear, this was a preliminary to the annexation of the Crimea by Russia in 1783. This was a bitter blow. The loss of Ottoman territories in Europe was hard, but could be borne. These lands were relatively recent conquests, with predominantly Christian native populations, ruled by a minority of Ottoman soldiers and administrators. The Crimea was another matter. It was old Turkish Muslim territory, dating back to the Middle Ages, and its loss was felt as part of the homeland. This was the first, but by no means the last, loss of Muslim lands and populations to Christian rule. It also marked the conclusive establishment of Russia as a major Black Sea power, posing a threat to the Ottoman and, more broadly, the Islamic lands, both on the European and the Caucasian shores. Clearly, new measures were needed to meet these new threats, and some of them violated accepted Islamic norms. The leaders of the Ulema, the doctors of the Holy Law, were therefore asked and agreed to authorize two basic changes. The first was to accept infidel teachers and give them Muslim pupils, an innovation of staggering magnitude in a civilization that for more than a millennium had been accustomed to despise the outer infidels and barbarians as having nothing of any value to contribute, except perhaps themselves as raw material for incorporation in the domains of Islam and conversion to the faith of Islam. The second change was to accept infidel allies in their wars against other infidels. The Ottomans were used to employing locally recruited Christian auxiliaries in their wars, and even contingents, whom they could treat as auxiliaries, from Christian powers with which they shared a common Christian enemy. The Ottoman records show that in addition to those of their Balkan subjects who embraced Islam, there were some who remained Christian and nevertheless served in auxiliary units attached to the Ottoman forces. There were even gestures towards sovereign Christian states, who helped as what we would nowadays call allies, though neither side would have used such a term at the time. For example, in the correspondence between the Sultan of Turkey and Queen Elizabeth of England at the end of the 16th century, the letters are mostly concerned with commerce, but they do occasionally refer to the common Spanish enemy, a shared concern of London and Istanbul at the time. It would be an exaggeration to call this an alliance, and it was certainly not on equal terms. In the documents, the Sultan, addressing the Queen, uses language indicating that he expects her to be loyal and firm-footed in the path of the vassalage and obedience, and to manifest loyalty and subservience to the Ottoman throne. The contemporary translation into Italian, which served as the medium of communication between Turks and Englishmen, simply renders this as sincera amicizia. This kind of diplomatic mistranslation was for centuries the norm. But the new relationship between the Ottoman state and its European friends, as well as its European enemies, was something quite different. By now, it was clear that something was going wrong, and more people in the governing elite, and even outside the governing elite, were becoming aware of it. Even worse, they were beginning to be aware that Europe was doing better, and that they were consequently weaker and more endangered. When things go wrong in a society, in a way and to a degree that can no longer be denied or concealed, there are various questions that one can ask. A common one, particularly in continental Europe yesterday and in the Middle East today, is, who did this to us? The answer to a question thus formulated is usually to place the blame on external or domestic scapegoats, foreigners abroad or minorities at home. The Ottomans, faced with the major crisis in their history, asked a different question. What did we do wrong? The debate on these two questions began in Turkey immediately after the signing of the Treaty of Karlovitz. It resumed with a new urgency after Küçük Kayanarka. In a sense, it is still going on today. Debates about what is wrong were not new. There was a long tradition of Ottoman memorialists, most of them members of the official bureaucracy, discussing the various domestic problems of the Ottoman state and society, suggesting causes, and proposing remedies. One such was a little book written by Lutfi Pasha, Grand Vizier of Suleiman the Magnificent, after his dismissal from office in 1541. In it, he offered some acute diagnoses of flaws in the Ottoman structure, and remedies that he thought should be adopted. Another was by a civil servant of Balkan origin called Kochu Bey, who in 1630 drew attention to weaknesses in both the civilian and the military services of the state and proposed reforms to deal with them. The basic fault, according to most of these memoranda, was falling away from the good old ways, Islamic and Ottoman. The basic remedy was a return to them. This diagnosis and prescription still command wide acceptance in the Middle East. But these memoranda were relatively calm in tone and primarily domestic in content. They do occasionally refer to the outside world. Lufti Pasha, for example, drew attention to the importance of sea power. The Ottomans, he says, are everywhere triumphant on the land, but the infidels are superior at sea, and this could be dangerous. He was right, of course, in this. It was European ships, built to weather the Atlantic gales, that enabled the West Europeans to overcome local resistance and establish naval supremacy in the Arabian and Indian seas. By the 18th century, even Muslim pilgrims going from India and Indonesia to the holy cities in Arabia would often book passage on English, Dutch, and Portuguese ships because it was quicker, cheaper, and safer. But the rise of Europe was marginal to the concerns of Lufti Pasha and the other early memorialists, primarily concerned with domestic and, in the main, administrative and financial matters. The new memoranda, after Karlowitz, are more specific, more practical, more urgent, and more explicitly, military. Also, for the first time, they make comparisons between the Islamic Ottoman Empire and its Christian enemies to the advantage of the latter. In other words, the question now was not only, what are we doing wrong, but also, what are they doing right? And of course, the essential question, how do we catch up with them and resume our rightful primacy? An important factor in the development of these new perceptions and in the literature in which they are expressed was travel, the reports and recommendations of travelers between the two worlds of Islam and Christendom. There had always been Western travelers in the East. They came as pilgrims visiting the Christian holy places, as merchants profiting, by permission of the sultans, from the rich Eastern trade, as diplomats serving in the embassies and consulates established by the European powers in Muslim capitals and provincial cities.